History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've figured out that they really don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it. If we take just a little initiative and ask a few questions, invest a little time, we're never going to regret it. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we're educated, we're also entertained, and we find ourselves inspired even by these stories from our greatest generation. That word freedom meant different things to different people after World War II, and the federal holiday we celebrate Monday takes us back to the quest for all Americans to be free at last, as the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said. Dr. King never served in the military. In fact, he was very vocal in his opposition to America's involvement in Vietnam. But his close associate, Ralph Abernathy, really his right-hand man in the civil rights movement, was a World War II veteran, and they both saw the example, the service and sacrifice of those courageous men and women in a segregated military in World War II, as laying important groundwork for the landmark moments that would follow. A lot of you have been reaching out to me about the new Netflix film, The 6888, which represents part of this legacy. Today, you're going to hear the voices of five different World War II veterans. But let's begin with some words from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. himself.
And see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation, and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., in his famous I've Been to the Mountaintop speech in Memphis in 1968, just before he was killed.
And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world.
As our nation remembers the legacy of Dr. King and the civil rights movement this week, here on Hometown Heroes, we're drawing your attention to a precursor to that, the service of approximately 1 million African-American men and women in World War II. We've heard about some of the life-threatening situations they faced overseas, but the inherent challenges of a still segregated military also presented opportunities for courageous stands that would fuel what happened in the decades that followed. One of those has come to be known as the Freeman Field Mutiny, described here by Mitch Higginbotham, a Tuskegee Airman who would fly with the 477th Bomb Group.
At that time, there had been a lot of unrest, racial unrest in the city of Detroit, and race riots had broken out all over Detroit and caused quite a crisis situation. The commanders at Selfridge Field was afraid that all was going to spill over into the military. They had segregated the officers' club there at Selfridge for white officers only, and blacks weren't permitted in the officers' club at Selfridge. Well, as a result of all this, the decision makers in Washington decided that we had to leave the Detroit area, and there was a service field available called Godman Field in Louisville, Kentucky. It's adjacent to Fort Knox, and it wasn't designed for that type of combat training at all. It was very insufficient, but that's where they relocated the 477th Bomb Group. And, of course, there wasn't a racial problem there because the little officers' club at Godman they were gladly relegated that to the black officers because the white personnel, officer personnel, could use the officers' club at Fort Knox, right, and it's approximately across the street. And so there was no problem there until when they found out how inadequate Godman Field, they decided to move the bomber group to Freeman Field, near Seymour, Indiana, which is about 40, 50 miles from Indianapolis. And we'd heard about some difficulties there in the officers' club. We had decided then that we couldn't tolerate that situation. And when we arrived there at Freeman, there was a group of some of our fellows thought that they would test entry to the officers' club. And, of course, the commander found out that this was anticipated, and he had designated the provost marshal to be there to see that his segregated orders were carried out. We had decided in pairs of threes or fours we would go over to test the officers' club. So that was where trouble began. And
well, you saw trouble coming, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, we did, really. We knew that it was going to be a confrontation, but didn't know what the nature of it would finally end up as. Commander Robert Selway, Colonel Robert Selway, then...
Who was white.
Yes, indeed, he was. And he, acting in collusion with his commander, I guess he was three or four star general, Hunter, was head of the entire 1st Air Force, which we were a part of. So Selway ordered the fellows that went into the club there to be arrested. They were placed in house arrest for overnight, and the next day he got the situation formalized, then whereby all of us would be given an opportunity, being interviewed one at a time and being ordered directly to sign papers that we read and understood the orders and would abide by them.
So you basically had to promise not to go into the all-white officers' club again.
Well, it was more than a promise. It was a matter of being individually ordered not to use by our immediate commanding officer and read the articles of war regarding direct orders in time of warfare. And one section which was emphasized was that refusal to obey a direct order in time of warfare was punishable up to and including death. And, of course, death was emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the face of all that, 104 of us refused to sign. There was about, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 black officers and maybe less than 100 white officers, maybe 85 or so. When the 104 of us refused to sign, General Hunter sent down, we were placed under arrest immediately.
Well, and I want to get into your mindset, because obviously there's strength in numbers, and if 104 of you are doing it, it's maybe a little easier than doing it all by yourself. But
you hit on a good point there.
Where does that courage come from, though? Well, what made you decide I'm not going to sign this?
This is where the difficult situation arose, because we had no idea how many would refuse. And if only a dozen or half dozen of us refused in the face of the Articles of War, then we would have been out on a limb all alone, and I'm sure that limb would have been sawed off.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that on principle we absolutely refused, and not knowing how many would be in our group. If it had been only a few, then, of course, they would have thrown the book at us. But being over 100 black officers in the black newspapers across the country, the Chicago Defender, Amsterdam News in New York, and the Pittsburgh Courier in Pittsburgh, which was the leading black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and that was read by white officers, and then across some of our white officers as well. But they put pressure, and then we had contacted NAACP. Well, first we were flown back.
Well, and I want to get all that timeline, but I'm really interested in your personal decision to do this, knowing that they could throw the book at you, that anything could happen up to execution. But you had the courage to stand up and say, this is wrong, I'm not signing this. Where did that come from? How did you arrive at that decision?
Well, I was always incensed by this kind of action. And I was determined, you know, it was a matter of principles that I just couldn't stomach to be a part of something that where, in first place, ordering you to sign your name, I felt was illegal. I didn't know, you know, but I just, from what the education and whatnot that I had, I knew it wasn't right. And I was determined to go by principles and face the music, so to speak.
No matter what it meant, nothing scared you off.
Well, it didn't. And you look back, we were 20-year-old guys, 21, 20, 19, some of us, and just were determined that, that we wouldn't succumb to that sort of arrangement.
So they arrested you.
They arrested, and General Hunter sent down three C-47s, and they marched us down to the flight lines, and the enlisted men were observing and taking pictures of what was going on with their cameras, and most of the cameras were confiscated, but some of them got through, and they had pictures on the front page of the black newspapers liking the situation to Hitler. actions in Germany. And so I have some copies of the Pittsburgh Courier citing these pictures and citing in the headlines the Gestapo type of operations that was occurring at Freeman Field, Indiana.
Well, that's a pretty powerful comparison, given everything that people had heard about what was happening in Europe.
Indeed. And in our lockup, we contacted them. NACP and Thurgood Marshall was head of the legal department. The NACP had agreed to represent us in a court-martial trial. So it was so much pressure. We had some influential black people, the professionals, the parents of many of us, and they applied pressure. The pressures exerted were sufficient to get a change, and they sent down a group of colonels from Washington to investigate the situation, and they investigated in Freeman, and they came down to Godman. We had a fellow named Coleman Young, who later became mayor of Detroit for four terms.
Yeah.
He was one of us, and he was maybe a year or two older than me, for instance. He had had some training as a labor leader in the auto workers union there in Detroit. So he had some kind of knowledge, and those kind of pressures eventually ended up in 101 of us being released with letters of reprimand placed in our files, reprimanding us for that type of disobedience. That remained on our records till 1995.
So for 50 years, even though you'd been released, you still had this.
Still had the reprimand on our records of 101. But the three that were court-martialed, Bill Terry, Marsden Thompson, and Shirley Clinton. Two of the fellows were found not guilty, I guess you'd call it, and one fellow was convicted in the court-martial.
And that was your roommate?
That was my roommate, Bill Terry. Bill Terry was convicted and fined $150.
But in 1995, he received a full pardon and got his $150 back. The so-called Freeman Field Mutiny, a significant moment on the path towards the integration of our armed forces. And eventually, the other developments that we celebrate this week in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. You can link to the original full-length interviews with the veterans you're hearing from today at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. One of the most frequently downloaded episodes at hometownheroesradio.com over the years is our conversation with the late Dr. Fitzalbert Marius. Long before becoming a pioneering heart surgeon, he was doing dirty work in the Pacific with the 725th Medical Sanitation Company.
Now, World War II was about the end of true world wars, true war. In World War II, the people you fought against was your enemy. Your job was to kill all of them or get killed and control all of them or be controlled. Not like today, where they go into these various places, allow them to continue to operate and help them trying to operate the right way. So until you got the Japanese controlled, so we understood that those were our enemies. Whatever they did, we suspect they were trying to get rid of us, so we got rid of them first. They were the enemy. We had some problems with our country, but they were the major enemy. And we weren't over there to solve prejudice. We were over there to take care of the enemy that had attacked America. And we understood you could not solve the problem in the United States of America if the Japanese controlled America. Right. So we had to get rid of that enemy first, and that's where we focused. So we didn't have the kind of attitude, well, I'm not going to work hard to do what is right to save America and hold up the American flag because they ain't treating us right. No, we didn't have that kind of attitude, you know. It's like I tell people, say, we grew up understanding life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Not like you young people today. Life, liberty, and happiness without pursuit. You just go out just simply because you woke up in the morning, you're entitled to everything I got. You're entitled to produce or have the opportunity to produce, but you're not entitled to the product. But that's how they feel today. I never expected to be able to return back to the United States of America. My attitude was, I am most likely going to die over in the South Pacific. So I did everything to keep me alive every day. But I never expected to get back home.
And what would you say were the times you look back on now as the close calls, as the closest you came to not coming home?
Well, one of the closest was when we hit Cebu City. We were on the ship, and we were not supposed to leave the ship because there were snipers in the city. But a group of us got together and said, Lord, you know, we've been all this time in the South Pacific and stuff, and of course, you know, the inhabitants were moved away, and we never ran across any women or anything like that, you know, and so on down the line, except, you know, nurses and stuff in the Army. So, man, you know, if we get into Cebu City, we might find some nice women we can work with. So what we did, we volunteered to help take some of the things off the ship, you know, down to the port. And of course, what we had planned is once we got down on the port, we would take off to Cebu City. So we were there sitting down in this square in Cebu City. We were there and we're drinking our booze and talking about, you know, where we're going to go to hunt up the women. And all of a sudden, the snipers opened on us. And this guy named Arthur was sitting next to me. Now, I'm here and you, Arthur, there. And I'm looking him in the eye. And the snipers opened up, and a bullet hit him right in the middle of the forehead and killed him right there with me looking dead at him. Anyway, the rest of us, there were eight of us, we all ducked down and stuff, and we got away from there and returned. Now, we had to report the death. So we reported the death, and of course, had to be honest, and and tell the captain, you know, how we managed to get there in the first place. He didn't put us in the brig, but what he did was this. He turned to me, because I was a corporal at the time, and he said, Corporal Marius, you are now responsible for alerting his parents of his death. And he put that ethos on me, and it was a tough one, because he wouldn't have died if it hadn't been us talking him into doing that. So that was one of the closest, you know, because I came across a lot of other things like, you know, bombs and stuff like that and rockets and things like that. But I was very, very fortunate. I didn't get not one injury the whole time. God was looking out for me.
And how hard was that to write that letter to his family?
Oh, man, it was really tough. I would have rather he stuck me in the brig than having to take that accountability. Yeah. Ooh, because, you know, when you're feeling guilty about your accountability in that and responsibility in that situation, and now you got to face a mother that you feel is you happen to be partly responsible for the death of her son. Oh, man, that was heavy on my butt.
And just hearing you talk about everything else and hearing you process the things that your remarkable life taught you, why do I have a feeling that that incident, that scenario, that real unfortunate incident taught you something?
Oh, naturally it taught me something. You know, let's face it, a lot of the things that you learn comes from the hard mistakes that you made. It's things like, for instance, Dr. Lowe, you know, in cardiac surgery, when you put into the aorta the major thing that you pump the blood back into the patient, you know, from the heart-lung machine. So it's a hole that you put a purse string around it and you tie it off and stuff like that. But then you have a small hole, which is kind of a needle hole, where you put a special good-sized needle where you clamp off the difference between that, and that's the one that you feed in the cold thing to stop the heart so that you can work on it. Now, Dr. Lowe, everybody else, when they take this one out, they tie it and then they put extra stitches and maybe sometime even a patch across it because it's a decent hole. But the little string that comes out that little needle hole, they just tie that off. Dr. Lowe, on the other hand, he treats the other one, you know, routinely, but he puts extra stitches and a patch across the needle hole that comes out. If you didn't know, now I was there when the incident occurred at Children's Hospital, so I know why he did it. He did it because one day that needle hole thing broke and the blood started pumping out of there, and we had to save the patient's life before we could get the patient back in surgery. He and I had to open up the patient's chest, reach in and put our finger and sew that hole up right there to save that patient's life. So from that point on, so his experience with that problem is what caused his reaction afterwards. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with us. A lot of things that we do is based upon the experiences that we have gone through. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is no experience that does not has an effect on your affect.
Well, I don't want to pry or put words in your mouth, but was the lesson of that experience with Arthur's death, was the lesson, don't put yourself in those kind of situations? Or what was it?
Well, the situation mostly was telling you, do what is right. Follow orders. You were told to keep your butt on the ship. You did not follow orders, and you're paying the consequence. You pay the price for the choice you make. And I'll say this about me. I have never been one who avoided saying that I'm paying the price. I have never been one who look around and make an excuse and say, well, if so-and-so made me do it. I go and look in the mirror first thing, and I say, Bert Marius, what did you do?
I'm curious about those guys that you served with. It's been so long now. How do you think they should be remembered? What was the significance of what you and those other guys did over there?
Well, it was an interesting unit because you only had three men there in the unit outside of the officer, you know, who was white, who had more than a second, third, or fifth grade education. They were from Biloxi, Mississippi, all of that unit except us. Now, my good friend who was from Boston, myself, and this guy, Arthur guy, who was from Chicago. We were the only ones with college education. As a matter of fact, when I found out, I went to the regional commander and I asked him, was it all right if I started classes to teach them? Most of them couldn't even write or read. So they gave me qualifications to teach them basic fundamental subjects, and they would get credit for it back in America. So I started classes, and a number of those guys hated me because of that. They were saying because I had intel, I wanted to make them look stupid. But my attitude was not that. My attitude was to teach them, you know, to help them. But they didn't take that attitude. And one of them who claimed he was a preacher of God, we were chopping down trees and stuff in the swamps, and somebody said, look out. And I turned, and this axe was coming towards my head. He was trying to chop my head off. And I had my axe, and I blocked his. And anyway, at that time, I was really tough and strong. And as a matter of fact, after I beat the heck out of that sucker, and I had him underwater and was going to choke him to death, they saved his life by taking my butt off of him. But he wanted to kill me. But then later on, he come want to invite me to come to services with him. I say, well, I'm going to services. This sucker wanted to kill me. He called himself. But I taught a number of them how to read and write. But in those days, they weren't as strict. They needed fighting men, and they needed men to do certain jobs, and they didn't give a hoot whether you could read, write, or whatever. Just follow the orders. So, yes, those men needed a lot of help, and, you know, I had a lot of things that I still, you know, based upon the kind of background and traditions that I grew up in among my family, that you be productive. You know, I tried even then to be productive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I painted a lot of watercolor paintings while I was over there, and I mailed them out and stuff. Mm-hmm. I have no idea where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even remember who I mailed them to or anything like that. So I don't know how many paintings I got around anywhere. When President Franklin D. Roosevelt died and Harry Truman took over, I became immediately depressed because here, this president was born in Missouri, a southern area. So there was no way in the world. Now, if I thought, you know, prejudicial things were running bad under Franklin D. Roosevelt, it was certainly going to be worse under Harry Truman. But to my amazement, Harry Truman removed discrimination from the armed force.
He integrated all of them.
That's right. He removed it completely. He did exactly the opposite of what I expected. So that's one of the greatest things that Harry Truman did during his administration.
Well, and he did it. I wasn't alive. I didn't see it. But don't you think one of the reasons he did it is because of what you guys did in the war and what you proved you were capable of, the allegiance and loyalty that you proved, even though you weren't getting everything you deserved here?
Well, I think Harry Truman did it because he had a heart change, personal heart change, and that's why he pushed it and did it. So he saw it was wrong, and he saw that all citizens should be treated exactly the same if they're going to sacrifice their lives for the country. So yes, he made a start for it. But remember, all of this went on, but it was not until you started to get to the times of Martin Luther King and all of those kind of, like I'm demonstrating that big painting in there, that you began to actively begin to change the civil rights situation, you know, little by little. When I got discharged in 1946 and went back to New York City, I went back to finish my last 2 years of college and pre-med, and I graduated in 1948. I applied to École des Beaux-Arts, Université de Paris. École des Beaux-Arts, the School of Wonderful Arts, and it was the finest art school in the world at the time, and I got accepted. So I was on my way down with a letter saying, yes, I'm coming. And I had the letter. And I remember I was living on 148th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And usually I walked down there, and 146th Street on that same side of the street is the post office and drop the mail and then go to 145th Street and take the subway down to work. But as I got to the vestibule, I remember I hadn't picked up the mail for yesterday. So I went to the mailbox and opened up the mailbox, and inside the mailbox was a letter from Howard University. So I opened up the letter, and the letter said, "You have been accepted to medical school at Howard University. Send a $50 retainer." At this time, you know, blacks at this time would jump 3 feet up in the air and say, "Lord, I'm in medical school." Instead, I took my cap and I banged it on the ground and started cussing and said, "God dog, now I got to make a cotton picking decision." And I said, "I'm not going to stress myself over this." And I got a silver half a dollar out of my pocket and I flipped it. And I said, "If it lands head, I'm going to medical school. If it lands tail, I'm going to Perry." And it landed heads. So I went all the way back upstairs, tore up the letter to Paris, wrote a check for $50, put it in the letter and a stamp on it, and mailed it. And I went to medical school on the flip of a coin. That was God working on my butt, not me. Because later I got to be thinking, I said, now, at this time, I hadn't given my heart and soul to Jesus Christ. I'm the only one standing in that vestibule. I said that to myself. Now, why didn't I, since I wanted to go to Paris, when it landed down, heads, I said, "Oh, it landed just like I wanted, heads for Paris." I could easily said that. Why did I keep my oath? It was the Lord working on my butt in spite of me. Because if that hadn't happened, no way in the world would I wound up here in Fresno. No way in the world would I be part of working with Byron Evans in 1958 to start the first open heart surgery here in Fresno. No way in the world would I have, after my wife had divorced me in 1966, would I have met my other wife, Dorothy, and become a Christian. She was part of the influence of me becoming a true Christian and giving myself truly to the Lord and Savior. None of that would have happened. I wouldn't have had my youngest son. None of that. Y'all would be paying big money for dressing up the clothing design by Fitzalbert Michel Marius.
All the celebrities would be wearing it, right?
That's right. All the celebrities would be wearing it because I would have been the first black designer in the world.
55 years of doing these kind of heart surgeries and all those patients that you dealt with, the lives that they led after that, the gift of life you're able to give to so many. What are you most proud of when you think back on that medical career? What gives you the most pride or satisfaction?
Well, the most thing that gives me the pride and satisfaction is that I have come to the point that I understand that anything and everything that Bert Maris is able to accomplish, it is because God gave me the ability to do it. All that matters is whether I am doing it according to his will, not according to my own desire. I can't remember the very last time that I had any anxiety about anything. Just like you see me and most people, and they always ask me, says, "How come you always got a smile on your face?" I said, "Because I got joy to come from within. I'm not stressed out about nothing. I go to bed every night absolutely peaceful. Without him, none of this is possible." You know, being a poet and stuff, I pray this way: "Thank you, Lord, for reminding me I'm burnt from dirt and would be completely inert if it were not for you." I thank the Lord for using me to further his kingdom in spite of my human deficiencies and inefficiency. That I'm not taking any credit for any of this myself. The only credit I've taken is the fact that I'm willing to submit to his will and be his steward and his messenger.
Dr. Fitzalbert Marius, one of our more memorable guests over the years here on Hometown Heroes. And we're not done yet. When we come back, three more of the roughly 1 million African-American veterans of World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
If we want to see that dream consistently fulfilled, it's up to each of us to set that example. And that's a sentiment echoed on this program by many over the years who served in America's then segregated armed forces during World War II. Earl Watson was part of the 1317th Engineer General Services Regiment building bridges in Europe.
We reached the Rhine River and we put a bridge across there in 11 days under fire. And that was a horrible thing. They don't call that a battle, the Rhine River, but it was a battle because it was under fire, and you could only stay up there about 3 hours because of the odor and everything else. And we got across that Rhine River, and to make a long story short, we ran into the Russians in the middle of Germany, where we were working on the train tracks, and ran into the Russians, and we knew the war was over because we met the Russians in the heart of Germany. And then after that, they said they were going to put us on a boat for 65 days, on our way to Manila, France, the Philippines. Go by home, go right by United States and not go home after 3 years. I'm telling you, it was an awful thing. And then they said in the ship, U.S. Harry Taylor, they said, watch the bow of the ship as it points towards New York. We're going home. And, man, we saw that Statue of Liberty from a little bitty dot until it grew very large, and we landed in New York and took a train upstate New York, and I had a very bad problem on the train. Train stopped for a half an hour, and all the soldiers got off, and they refused to sell me an American hot dog after all that time. And I was crying, and I didn't want to argue with the guy that was selling the hot dogs. And the white soldiers asked me, how come I don't have a hot dog? And I told him he refused to sell me one. So they ordered me three hot dogs, and wouldn't pay them for their hot dog, and said they ought to beat them up. And we got on the train, and it went on up to Camp Shanks up there in New York. And then I was discharged from the Army, and being from Chicago, where it's so cold and living during the Depression and everything, that I decided that I would take my release and go to California and live with my sister and my brother.
That move to California ended up connecting him to quite a few celebrities. Once he became the doorman at Hollywood's Knickerbocker Hotel, the late Earl Watson even wrote a book about that. Tuskegee Airman Frank Macon also wrote a book that I have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The runway where Frank learned to fly is the one cadets at the U.S. Air Force Academy now use in Frank's native Colorado Springs. But heading to Alabama as a young pilot during World War II brought some new experiences for Frank.
I wasn't used to being down south, and I wasn't used to that because the school I went to was integrated. Native Americans, Mexicans, and blacks were all, and along Irish and everybody else was, you know. And so it was just really confusing to me. And water, I had to go into this bathroom or a toilet, you know, facility. Or I couldn't drink out of this fountain and all of that. And it was just really ridiculous, and I had just never been involved in anything like that.
And, of course, a lot of these pilots that you're studying with and training with had grown up in the South and had a much different experience. How eye-opening was that for you to glean some of what they'd been through?
The thing was that, well, I couldn't understand anything they were saying, and they couldn't understand anything I was saying. When they found out I came from Colorado, well, the first thing was, we're fighting the Indians all the time, you know. And, of course, I'd just play it up. And my grandfather was Indian. And they wanted to know, well, how do you do out there? I said, well, of course he wasn't. I said, well, my grandfather's chief of the tribe, you know. And the guys from Denver, there was some in there, you know. And they just help along with them. There were so many phraseology I was used to. I just had no knowledge of the way they talked, and it was really confusing. In basic, we were in Biloxi, Mississippi. It was strange. I don't know how to put it, but having to go to a separate restroom or something like that. And I said, well, I'll be glad I get out of this place, you know. And then, of course, got to Tuskegee, and Tuskegee's really not in the town of Tuskegee. It's in a place called Greenwood. It's a suburb. And if you went to Tuskegee, the town, the atmosphere was much different. You could just feel it, you know. But out in Greenwood, you just didn't see any whites. Of course, now when we got to, and our instructor, we're all black. But then when we got to the air base, started in basic and advanced, all of those were whites. And a lot of them are from the north, so they weren't too bad.
And, you know, with the lens of history, we can look back now and say that what all of you did during World War II, the African-American soldiers, sailors, airmen who risked their lives, laid the groundwork for the civil rights movement, that they showed our blood is just as red as any other American, that if we can die for our country, we deserve some rights. We say that now, but did you guys have a sense then that there was something you had a chance to prove?
Now, I don't know about the rest of the group, but I didn't feel that I had anything to prove. I knew what I could do, and I had learned to fly before I even went there, and they cautioned me here, never mention that you know how to fly. So I didn't, and an airplane was just as normal as an automobile to me. So my mindset was not as the others.
Well, you hadn't dealt with the degree of prejudice in your life that they had, I guess.
No, and the other thing is I felt much different than most of them because I just didn't seem to think like they thought, you know. I was practically raised with white people, you know, and they used to say that, what do they call it? Say that you're an Oreo, you're dark on the outside and white on the inside. Mm. You know. And I guess that's true, but I didn't realize it. I don't look at a white person. I do not look at a, quote, black person. And those terminologies, I have never seen a white person in my life, and I've never seen a black one. You take a piece of paper, a white, and put your hand on her, you're not white. I take that same black piece of paper and put it on her. And this color and dividing people up by color or something like that is stupid. Just absolutely stupid.
You would not have found any argument to that from Frank Macon's fellow Tuskegee Airman Bob Friend, who flew 142 missions in P-51 Mustangs in the 15th Air Force during World War II. If you've ever seen the film Red Tails, you have an idea of how expendable those red-tailed P-51s were in their role of protecting the all-important bombers as their first line of defense.
We were that. There's no doubt about that. And certainly... the objective was to allow that bomber to do its mission. And certainly, yes, we were the buffer. But strangely enough, they didn't concentrate on us nearly as much as they did on trying to get the bombers down. So it was fairly easy, as a rule, to chase them off. Don't get me wrong, they would get through sometime because... they'd get above and start a dive and just dive straight through. It's almost like suicide. You're going to get caught and picked up after, if not before he gets there. But they, too, had an objective, and that was protect their homeland.
And they had a variety of different planes. At the end of the war, they had planes that were faster and superior to even the one you were flying. Did you ever engage any of those ME-262s?
Yes, I met a 262, and... strangely, I met him head-on, and I didn't realize we were going head-on. I thought first that I was overtaking him. The silhouette looked the same, but then when I saw the guns firing, I knew that we were coming toward each other, and we went right past. When I turned around, he was gone.
That's one of those you don't even figure out what it was till it's gone, huh?
Well, dogfights are funny. It can be going on, you know, rather heavily. And then all of a sudden, there's nothing. Everybody's gone. Some people took off for home, others. And it was important for us not to go chasing after them because if you did, you left the bombers open to secondary attacks.
I thought that was a dynamic that was well depicted in the George Lucas film, Red Tails, that aspect of, hey, you got to stick to the plan, not be going for the glory and chasing down a fighter. Was that ever a temptation of yours to go after one of those German planes?
Well, you know, it's like once you get locked on to him, you know, you don't want to let go. But we had some well-grounded discipline, and that was don't be drawn off.
Where did that come from?
The commander. Colonel Davis was a man that had a tough job. What he had to do was to take people who were relatively raw. All of us, how far much more experience could you say one had? You know, guy graduated in first class, guy graduated a month later in second class. And he, from these people, had to take people for, or identify people for key positions. Squadron commanders, group operations officers, squadron operations officers, maintenance officers, you know. And he had to get the right guy, best of all. He recognized when he had made a mistake with a guy, and he made the change right away. He did not mess around.
That's leadership for you. With all those missions, I'm sure you had plenty of close calls. But is there one for you that when you think back on, you feel like, you know, God was really looking out for me on that one?
Yes. We had some of those. I had a barge explode, and I flew through all that debris. Got through okay, and the ones that, not direct, but it happens, when on one mission, the fellow that was going to lead the mission said, who's flying Charlie today? Charlie was the last position in the squadron.
Tail and Charlie.
So I said, I'm flying Charlie. So he said, well, let's switch airplanes. Mine's a newer airplane, and Charlie has a lot more activity, you know, staying in formation and so forth. So you take that and I'll fly yours. He never came back. The airplane quit on him.
So that would have been you in the airplane that quit.
Yes. And other instances when attacking a ground target, you can see the rounds coming. And actually you can do things about it. If it looks like it's going to hit you, you're okay because it goes like this. But if it looks like it's going by in front, be careful. You better change something, change speed, change direction, change something, because it was pretty much hanging on to you then.
I'm sure you found plenty of bullet holes in your planes, but with stuff like that, with that anti-aircraft fire coming at you, what's the closest it actually came to hitting you? You personally, I mean your body, not your plane.
I never came close to being hit. I know that there were friends who had rounds go through the cockpit. You know, one guy, the first aid kit was behind your back, took the first aid kit out. Another one, the round died just as it got there, and it stayed stuck in his windshield. Yeah.
Close enough. How much did you enjoy the plane you were flying? For people that haven't experienced that airplane, what was it like for you?
That airplane, the P-51, absolutely so far ahead of its time, it really can be said that it swung the war. It swung the things in our direction without question. And as far as the pilots feel, I didn't feel like I climbed into an airplane. I felt like I put it on. I wore it.
And the look on your face says you wouldn't mind wearing it again, that you would go out there right now if there was one out here on the tarmac.
I certainly would love to. Yeah, I know that people think I'm a little too old for that, but I don't think you ever forget some things, and that's one of them. They've let me fly the airplane sometime after we got up, and I fly it okay.
Yeah. Why do you think it's important to tell the story of the Tuskegee Airmen? What's the value of that for us today in knowing what you guys did and what you went through?
Well, I think the most important aspects of it is not to let it happen again. The reason we don't need it again. I think that all you have to do is look at the relationship to the people at events like this. Much different. Much different. Some people, these people that you would probably never have had words for. What do you say? I know that the country itself has just absorbed so much in the way of the business and race relations. I feel that we should not even bother with considerations about race. I'm not saying that people should be not like their heritage. I like mine. I'm proud of my heritage. You know? But I don't think that it should be something that we say African-American, Indian-American, Mexican-American, Latin-American, German-American, Canadian-American. Who needs that? You're an American or you're not.
You're either an American or you're not. The late Tuskegee Airman Bob Friend with that memorable quip. As we honor and celebrate the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., may we all live in a way that prioritizes the content of our character, as Dr. King said. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.